You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 423 of the Columbia Calling podcast. This week's very special guest is, well, for many people, he needs no introduction. He's the journalist and director of HechoInCali.com. That's HechoInCali.com. He's a human rights journalist. His name is Jorge Luis Galeano Bolaños. And we're going to be talking about 1 year on from when Cali, the southwestern city in Colombia, became the flashpoint for the Paro Nacional, or the demonstrations against the government. So an incredibly important one. 1 year on, so from 2021 to now to 2022. What has happened? Has anything changed? Is the city still on edge? And I can think of no one better to tell us about this than someone who was reporting on the ground from the scenes during, well, almost 3 months of protests in that city. And of course, thank you to everyone who signed up and tuned in to last week's episode with the director of Columbia Reports, Adrian Alsima. He really gave us the lowdown on what the falsos positivos, or the false positives, are, and in the context of the hearing a couple of weeks ago in Ocaña Norte Santander regarding those, well, war crimes. And so I think if you're interested at all in what's going on in Colombia, you should listen to episode 422. And it's a very coherent and very clear conversation that we have about this really quite nefarious sequence and set of events that took place here. Well, this week, the Columbia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News. It's a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. So you can sign up for a 14-day free trial at www.latinnews.com. That's all the letters. That's LATINNEWS.com. And of course, our other sponsor is BNB Colombia Tours, experts in custom-made travel throughout Colombia. The team at BNB Colombia Tours can provide you and your loved ones with a fantastic private experience, creating wonderful memories of Colombia you'll cherish for a lifetime. So do check out the website at www.bnbcolombia.com. Complete the free itinerary form and tell them that I sent you, and you'll receive a further 5% off their already great prices. So if you're looking for Caribbean beaches, beautiful colonial towns, packages, including indigenous experiences or whale watching, do check out bnbcolombia.com. And of course, latinnews.com, your 14-day free trial for all the news and analysis, economic, political analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean. Thank you again to our sponsors. We'll go right over now to Matt DeSalvo, who will be delivering this week's news. Brief, Emily Hart cannot be with us this week. She'll be away for a couple of weeks. There's other commitments there, but Matt will take over for the next couple of weeks. And then in segment three, we'll be talking to Jorge Luis Galeano of HechoInCali.com. So thank you for listening, and don't go away.
I'm Matthew DeSalvo, and these are your top stories for the week of May the 9th, 2022. Paramilitary boss and drugs trafficker Dairo Antonio Osuga, more commonly known as Otoniel, was extradited to the US on Wednesday on drugs and firearms charges. Otoniel, who led the Gaitanist Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, also known as the Gulf Clan or Urabeños, will face federal drugs trafficking charges in New York. Otoniel was accused of smuggling an outrageous amount of cocaine into America, according to a prosecutor. President Iván Duque had previously compared the capture of the criminal to the 1993 death of drug lord Pablo Escobar. Otoniel led one of Colombia's largest organized criminal gangs. The Gulf Clan is a paramilitary group that has presence in many of Colombia's departments, especially rural areas. It is heavily involved in cocaine trafficking, as well as extortion and illegal gold mining. It is unknown how much of a dent, if any, Otoniel's capture and extradition will make to the Colombian drug trade. At least six people have been killed during an armed strike announced by the Gulf Clan following the extradition of Otoniel. The armed group shut down huge parts of the north of the country in retaliation for the extradition of their leader. At least 11 of Colombia's 32 departments have been affected by the chaos. Nearly 200 cars were torched and roads were closed, including to popular tourist destinations like Santa Fe de Antioquia, by the group. Civilians were forced to stay at home during the strike and bus companies cancelled services. The armed strike even reached the city of Medellin, Colombia's second largest city, where the group forced residents to stay indoors and businesses to shut in the neighborhoods where it operates. Colombian Defense Minister Diego Molano said that extra troops would be sent to support almost 50,000 personnel already deployed. Presidential frontrunner Gustavo Petro last week said that a criminal gang was planning to kill him. Petro, who leads in the polls, cancelled his campaign rallies in the coffee region at the start of last week because of the alleged plot. Petro made the announcement on Twitter after receiving information from his security team. Medellin Mayor Daniel Quintero also said on Twitter that a large landowner from Antioquia had made a similar assassination plan. According to Petro, a criminal organization called La Cordillera, which operates in the department of Risaralda, had hatched the plan. Colombia's Fiscalía has since opened an investigation into the matter. Ahead of the elections, Colombia's Interior Ministry said it would be prioritizing security measures in certain regions to prevent the possible interference of illegal armed groups. 99 of 1,300 municipalities in the country are labeled for electoral risk posed by illegal armed groups, according to the government, and these areas will receive extra security to voters on election day. And the pandemic appears to be coming to an end in Colombia. The government last week removed mask mandates for indoor public spaces in all major cities. Gerson Bermont, the Ministry of Health's Director of Promotion and Prevention, said that this was due to the high vaccine uptake and natural immunity in the country. Masks are still required in hospitals and on public transport. And in schools, colleges and universities, students are required to use masks until May the 15th. In other coronavirus news, the government announced Friday that it would be offering a second coronavirus booster shot to people aged 50 and over. Those eligible for the second shot get it 4 months after receiving their first, the government said. Those were your top stories for the week. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next Monday.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling, episode 423. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, Colombia. And my very special guest is in Cali. We've got a journalist who dedicates himself to human rights reporting. His name's Jorge Luis Galeano Bolaños. He's the director of HechoEnCali.com. That's HechoEnCali.com. And they've been doing important reporting over the last, obviously, couple of years. And indeed, in-depth reporting and what went on in Cali a year ago. You'll remember that the Paro Nacional basically occupied the whole country in various parts more than others, and Cali was a flashpoint. So I can think of no better person than a local journalist on the ground to explain to us a little bit more about what took place and a year later, what is happening. So welcome on the Colombia Calling podcast, Jorge Luis.
Richard, thank you very much for having me. I'm very glad, a little nervous to be here, speaking everything in English, but I will try to do my best.
Well, I know that you learned your English in Wisconsin, and that at the time you did this, I don't think there were any Spanish speakers up there, so you speak English perfectly.
Thank you.
You know, those of you who learn English often speak better grammatically than the rest of us, because we just talk it. So I don't have any worries and any fear. I have had people on the show who freeze up in English, but you shouldn't, because this is your, as we say in Spanish, your pan de cada día. This is your bread and butter, is this reporting. So tell us a little bit about HechoEnCali.com.
Well, it's a little local media, digital media, that specializes in human rights. We don't do news. We don't do day-by-day news. We try to learn about stuff and then report in long articles. Mm. We could do podcasts, writing, videos, or whatever the issue takes us. Mm. And we want to explore how human rights are handled here in Cali. We have our coverage in the city because we're a small media. We're only two people working and some collaborators from time to time who join us and give us some insights. But that's what we do. We do that. We've been working for 5 years, more or less, doing only human rights reports from Cali. So that's what we do.
Wow. And so let's jump right into the you know, the meaty subject of this episode. I mean, you must have been working day and night a year ago, because Cali, I mean, we never really think of it as the flashpoint. You know, you always think of everything centralized in Bogota. Bogota is the rebellious city, you know. Bogota is the city that elected a former guerrilla as mayor. Bogota then elected, you know, openly lesbian sort of centrist, I would say, mayor. But Cali, it's always been a curious city on that, because it kind of feels to me like a frontier city for the Southwest, but you must have been working. What happened? Let's start from the very beginning.
What happened? Well, as everybody remembers, government announced, you know, some reform, an economic reform, and people just didn't like it. That was the beginning of it. People didn't like it, and that's how people just jumped to the street, went to the streets, and tried to say, tell the government, we do not agree with that. Mm-hmm. But the thing, Cali, is that, as you said, is the most important city in Southwest Colombia. Mm-hmm. So we receive people from all over Southwest. We receive people from Nariño, Cauca, Chocó, etc. So here we have a combination of a lot of tragedies that happen around Colombia, because most of the people who come here are for displaced because of the armed conflict. So that means that Cali has high levels of poverty, high level of criminality, and everything. So it happened, okay? So the government announced that reform that people didn't like. So everybody went to the street. But that wasn't only the thing that was worrying people, because people were hungry, people were jobless, they didn't have any jobs. So everything just got mixed up, you know, because the government, it took the government like, I think, 5-6 days to start backing up. Say, no, this is not the reform we're going to make. We're going to make some changes. And the people say, we don't want changes. We don't want that reform at all. Mm. So, you know, between 8 days after everything began, the government said, okay, we're not going to do the reform. But that wasn't enough, because people were still on the streets because of all the economic situation that we have here in Cali. So Cali became the center of the paro, of the national strike, if you will, because everybody was just saying, this is not enough. We've been suffering for years and years, and nobody's listening. We are telling the governments this one before, the one before, the one before, the one before, that we need changes, and nobody listens. So people just was fed up. All of these needs combined to make Cali what it was, you know? And it was very interesting, because when the protest began, we never thought it was going to go the way it went. I mean, it was amazing because, well, amazing, I mean, how people organize themselves without anybody telling them. Young people especially started to see, okay, we have to do something else besides protesting on the streets. We've had to make a stand, a serious stand, so the government listens. So that's what started happening. And, you know, the blocking streets, young people organizing the little groups to say, okay, we're going to stay in these places. We're not going to leave them. We're not going to go to our houses. We're not going to stay. And we need organizations. Mm-hmm. So I think the rest of the country, Colombia, just started seeing that in the first days, and they started to copy that in all the cities. Mm-hmm. But Cali is the center of the southwest of the country, and that anger that had been, you know, feeding up for so long, people just, you know, exploded in April last year.
What, I mean, it was amazing because, you know, it really did explode. And like you said, it was the economic reform that was the spark.
Yeah.
And nobody wanted that. And the government didn't get it. They didn't understand that this was going further, that this, the unrest, I mean, nationwide, maybe less in some places than others. And, you know, places like Cartagena don't really ever demonstrate, or Barranquilla, but the sort of real economic motor like Cali, Bogota, and some, to some extent, Medellin, the government didn't get it. That the you know, had they moved faster, they might have, you know, let's say, placated a little bit. But they moved so slowly, and so that allowed everyone to get angry and say, well, you know, what about the environment? What about the killings of the social and community leaders? What about the peace accords? What about, even I saw people, you know, like five people protesting against shark fin hunting. You know, every single issue was being touched. And what amazed me is, you know, watching the news in Cali, and of course going out in Bogota and taking photos, but in Cali, what amazed me the most was, how long did it take the president to even get there? And when he went, he went for like at midnight for like an hour or something, and then came back to Bogota. I mean, it's total ignorance of the situation.
Yeah, there was that also fueled the anger of the people, of course, because when finally the president decided to come here, as you said, he came here at night. Mm. Like very late at night, after 12, after midnight, and he actually went to the airbase. He didn't even come to Cali, the city itself. That was one thing. The other thing that he did was he just completely disregarded the mayor's authority. He sent the general Zapatero to control everything that has, and on top of everything that was happening, those decisions just gave the people the message that the president didn't care. Mm. The president just didn't care, and the president wasn't going to do what he had to be done. He never invited people for talks. All his reactions were military, through the military and through the police. That's all. He never said, okay, let's sit down, let's hear what they have to say, let's try to work things out. He never gave that chance. No. So he came the first time to the airbase. Then he disregarded the mayors, Cali's mayor, and he sent Zapatero, general, the army commander, and who controlled all the operations here. But then he came a second time, and it was worse, because when he came here, he came after this incident between indigenous people and some inhabitants in the south of the city. He went to that neighborhood. He never went to talk to the indigenous as well as the other people. He just went to the other people, talked to them. And that was worse. I mean, the people, hey, we are our citizens. Mm. You are the president of everybody. You're not just president from some people who keep voting for you. Mm. So, I mean, it was no way. There was not one chance of negotiation. Mm. The government never gave that chance, and it was tragic, because that led to killing people, that led to hurting people bad, and, you know, like people losing eyes, getting hurt. I mean, it was bad. It was a big tragedy here in Cali, and not even that stopped the government of not reading right the situation. I mean, the government just thought that it was a matter of police. It was a matter of military control. And it was not. It was never about that. It was people yelling and telling, we have needs. We are hungry. We don't have jobs. We need other decisions. Mm-hmm. We need to talk to you. And the government never gave the chance to do that. Mm-hmm. That was sad. It was sad. And as you said, we had to work 24 hours. It was crazy. It was crazy because people were asking for help all the time. They were sending videos, requests, and like, it was crazy. It was amazing. It was
You've mentioned it now, is that Cali, there were a lot of people killed, and there are still people we don't know who were disappeared.
Yeah,
I hate the term. They were, they've been disappeared, and there were obviously grave abuses of human rights. Perhaps from your perspective, you could tell us some of the figures and some of what happened, because when we were very disconnected up here. We're just getting, we can watch or we can read alternative media to get a more objective, let's say, look at what's going on. But the reality is everybody's watching the two main outlets, RCN and Caracol, and they are spinning one side of the narrative. The clips that we saw were like running gunfights. And tell us a bit about how it was to report and what it was, what was going on.
It was crazy, Richard. It was bad and it was sad because every night we receive videos of people running, yelling, just being shot. It was bad, and there were some days, specific days where were really, really bad. And to tell people and to tell you that last week, for example, one of the sectors that was very, very affected by the military operations was the neighborhood called Silouen. And they, the community and some organizations there, decided to create a people's court to investigate and to try to find out the truth about those military operations that led to killing young people. But in that sector, in Siloe, for example, on May 3rd, people were just having a meeting on the street, remembering a kid that was killed the day before, Nicolas Guerrero. I think, he was very, very well known. And people in Siloe were just getting together, remember him, they were lighting some candles, everything was peaceful. And out of nowhere, the SMAT, which is the police squad to attend strikes and everything, just went against them, just like that. And after that, the police, and after that, the army and a group of special operations, it's just like they were fighting like another army. It was crazy. And young unarmed people facing a special operation team from police and the army. I mean, that's crazy. And that night, three young men were killed. One of them hasn't been established the cause of death after 1 year. It was crazy. So, and every night we had to receive and report that. And as you said, the majority of the reports were not made by the media, the people themselves. They took their phones and started, recording or broadcasting live what was happening. And what we had to do was to tell them, to every time they are broadcasting live, tell the date, the place, and the time, so we can somehow say it is happening, it is reliable. Not because the other thing was how many information we received that was not reliable, and that was the other great challenge we had to filter every information.
Well, that's the key thing, isn't it? Because the first thing that anyone will say is that it's fake and it came from another time. To make it verifiable was probably your hardest job.
Yeah, exactly. And as I said, we are a small media. We don't have neither the technology nor the people to filter all the information we were receiving. I had to ask help many, many times to bigger media. There is a media here in Colombia, Colombia Check, that specializes in checking information. So I had to send them a whole lot of videos. Like, people are saying this, please help me. I have no idea how to do this. And it was crazy. But going back to the question you asked, so May 3rd happened there in Siloe, and a year after, their families are still asking for justice. Justice in Colombia is not working. Justice is just, stopped. They're taking these cases so slowly that people are frustrated. So that's why they created this people's court to find out the truth. This court is not gonna give jail to the guilty people, of course, but it's gonna help to find the truth. Another day there was terrible here in Cali and also in Siloe was May 28th. And it was particularly sad because one kid was killed in a fire on a store. And the story is bad because police and the authorities said that this kid was trying to rob the store. You know, he went to the store and was trying to rob, and the store just went on fire and he got caught in the fire. And the family is saying that it's not true because the family has videos, has a lot of testimonies that say that the kid was outside and he was shot, killed, and then dragged into the store. And, you know, and that family is trying to say, we are going to find out the truth. Mm. And I can tell you how stories like that, because in the 20 and some blocking sites that the people created, there were young people dying. Mm. Young people dying every time.
Do you think it was, let's say, an order from the top down, just regain authority by whatever means? Or do you feel that just some, let's say, battalions of police or riot police or the military just took the law into their own hands? I mean, how do you feel that it panned out?
Yes, that's a big discussion here in Colombia between those who believe that when things like that happened, when a young person was killed by a police or a soldier or something, it's just because that police officer or that soldier just went crazy, just, you know, lost it and he was shot. The popular rotten apple.
Yeah,
it's not the institution.
Una manzana podrida. Yeah.
Exactly. And on the other hand, there are those who think that there's a big problem with the institution as a whole. I mean, there are a lot of things happening inside the institutions that allow those things to happen. And you know, and you see the numbers, we might think that there is a problem with the institution. In Cali, we say INDEPAS, which is a big institute, an organization who, recorded and had all the information. According to them, in Cali, there were 25 people killed. And we don't know if those dates, I mean, probably that data is not the whole information. There are a lot of people who did not want their cases to be known because they were afraid. Mm. You know, they were threatened, so they did not tell anything. But let's say 25, mm-hmm, in Cali. Those 25 in the past says that were killed by police officers or soldiers, because in total they have 42 people killed. But 25 were killed. So I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to believe that if you have 25 people killed by an institution, the problem is just people, not the problem is the institution. I think there is a big, big problem with how they handle the situation. If you think about how General Zapatero announced the operation, he never announced the operation as a regain order. He announced the operation as a military operation. Okay, so that gave all his men the free pass, yeah, to do whatever they wanted.
Yeah.
And that's dangerous. And that's why people don't see that. When a general says we're going to regain order and then display, I don't know, thousands of military heavily armed against civilians, I mean, what can you expect to happen?
Yeah.
So it's crazy. So I think there is a problem with the institutions. I think they have to change them.
I would say something, and we've said it a lot of times on this podcast before, but the need to separate and to extract the police force from the Ministry of Defense, you know, it needs to be a more socially aware force. Therefore, it's not, we are not in the 1980s or early 1990s where, you know, to an extent it's justified that it's a military force because of the rampant cartel violence in the streets and so on. But we've moved beyond that now, and the things need to change. But I don't know. You talked about the families perhaps not coming forward because they're afraid of when they receive threats and retribution and everything. Do you get threatened for reporting on these issues?
No. We've been safe. We've been, fortunately, we haven't got any threats of any kind. We we've been able to do our job freely. And that's a very good thing, because what people need now is this kind of information.
Yeah.
Because when a journalist gets threatened, a media gets threatened, that is a pretty big problem for democracy, because people, you know, are blocked to be informed correctly. Mm-hmm. So they don't have as many choices to understand a so complicated issue such as the national strike, because the national strike has a lot of things to understand, not only what happened on the streets, but what happens next, what is going on now, which is a consequence of the strike. So no, fortunately we've been doing our really, and no problem so far.
I'm glad to hear it. I want to go into the strikes from the year ago, because Cali obviously gained a reputation, and now I understand from people I know in Cali, how long did the paro nacional last in Cali? How many days did it last?
I don't exactly know the number, but it went from April 28th, which is the first day, and it went all the way to the end of July, something like that. It was, I think, a day, or probably the day where the last block inside was just...
It was a tiny one, right to the end, at the university or something, was it? Somewhere around there.
Yeah.
Now, because my curiosity is that I understand, and this is again what I've been told, is that it moved from being, let's say, a paro nacional to demand improvements and demand that the government acknowledge the difficulties, but then it evolved into something else, that maybe, would you say, organized crime got involved later on, because I know that Siloe, as you've suggested, I mean, it is a very, what do we call it? They're not comunas in Cali. What are they called?
Comuna.
It's a comuna.
Yeah.
It's a humble barrio. It's a very working class barrio.
Yeah.
And it seemed that the paro was then taken over by criminal elements. At least that's what I've been told. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of rumors and a lot of people who belong to the Primera Línea. Mm. Who later said that they were infiltrated by some people belonging to criminal organizations that wanted to exploit the disorder. They wanted to exploit the chance to recruit some of the young men to take over some territory, so taking advantage of what was going on. And that is true. And there are videos and there are testimonies who can confirm that. So that was part of the problem. And the problem was that gave the government excuse to keep doing what it was doing. People were trying to say, look, 90-something percent of the problem was peaceful. Mm. That's what the information is, 90-something percent. Mm. The other was just what we saw in the media and all the chaos. But in amidst all that chaos, criminal organization just took advantage, and there are a lot of rumors which I cannot talk on here right now about rumors, but there are people who did some stuff inside those groups.
And then when we saw, was it in Ciudad Jardín? Is that the place where we got the footage of local people coming out of their, I guess you would say, Strato 6, Colombia is stratified. If you live in Strato 6, you have high income and living in a high rent district. If you're Strato 1, working class, and it's subsidized by Strato 6. People who know Colombia will understand that. Now, Strato 6, people came out armed and were shooting at protesters. And we saw images of that. And, of course, the famous guy, Andres Escobar, unfortunately, we know his name because he became the image of this. But I mean, how can I, I would never own a gun. That's the starters. But to go out and shoot, they're protesters. Yes, my property is at risk, but I still wouldn't shoot my fellow man. So for me, as a kind of, I guess, liberal on that sense, I just don't understand it. I don't understand it.
it's very hard to understand. Even for us, it's very, very hard. It was very hard to see that. It was very hard when those people just went out armed, started shooting to students, because there were a lot of incidents in that sector, not only with the students, but also with the indigenous people I told you about before. And there were also people heavily armed. And we're not talking about pistols.
No.
We're talking about rifles.
Yeah.
We're talking about people who went out with bulletproof chest vests, you know, like trained people who knew what they were doing, and people, civilian people, armed, heavily armed, next to police officers, and the police did not stop them.
Yeah,
and it was sad. So we don't really. It was shocking for us to see that reaction, and I think that has to do with how people see this stratification, because one part of the problem of stratification is you live in six and you're a high income person, and actually you live like in a fantasy world, you don't understand the need of other people, you see, and you try to live in like we call it the bubble, and that's your world, and everything outside that does not exist, does not deserve to exist. Or it's a nuisance for me. So it has to be stop, block, eliminated in the worst case scenario. So I think that's part of the problem. You know, they did not understand the protest. All they saw was the destruction. So they care more about a wall. They care more about a bus. They care more about the infrastructure than people's lives, you know? So even today, they justify those actions. They say we would do it again. They say we have to stop all those, and they confuse every time the protest with communism. And that's the narrative now. So everybody who is going to protest against government is a communist. So the war is justified because we don't want a communist system here in our country. So we'll do whatever it takes to prevent it. And that has come way to the elections too.
Yeah.
The election has kept that narrative.
That's what the issue. There's so many issues there that are striking and worrying. Is that, you know, first people have these weapons. Let's just stay with that. I mean, they have semi-automatics and so on, and pistols and rifles and bulletproof vests. And then secondly, the police do nothing. So it encourages vigilantism of this type. I don't condone violence on any side. Let me just get that out. If the protesters are creating violence, you know, I am the first to condemn it as well. Equally so, the private citizens coming out with their guns and the police doing nothing, that takes away authority from, you know, the government establishments, which again encourages these people. I mean, that's the part. And as you say, the justification comes. And it's all tied in now. We've got elections on May 29th, the first round.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And they say, oh, yeah, they're all communists. They're all leftists. They want us to become Cuba and Venezuela. When there is no relevance to that argument in this context. And, I mean, that's what is so upsetting about it. It doesn't allow for a dialogue. It doesn't allow for adults to talk because...
Exactly.
It becomes a shouting match from both sides. One side saying, you know, we want to be able to eat three meals a day and we want to be able to get our produce to highways to sell, so like campesino, or the indigenous people. We want a recognition of our rights and the environment, as well as the Afro-Colombians, as well as whomever else, and our culture and society. And then on the other side, you're saying you're destroying private property, which is happening. But it's also about maintaining the status quo. And it makes it a very worrying situation because today nothing has changed. You know, the strikes took place. And at the end, the government created the Gran Mesa de Diálogo or whatever and didn't really even turn up to it. And then it was COVID, so that was all, you know, put onto the back burner. Now we're going into an election. So 1 year on, Jorge Luis, have we seen any change in Cali? I mean, what is going on 1 year on?
It's very difficult to measure change like in such a short period of time after what happened. But what we've seen is that more people are at least aware of the importance of participation in politics, in elections, and the idea of democracy. I think that's one thing that we should, you know, praise.
Yeah.
Because before the strike, we didn't have that. We didn't have the discussions we're having. We didn't have the intensity of campaigns that we're having now. Mm-hmm. And so many young people involved in that kind of discussion. And I think that's part of it is a consequence of the strike, because during the strike, and as the time went on, say May, say June, people start asking themselves what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. What are we going to do after the strike? It's our next step. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very interesting to see that most of them, a lot of young people that were on the streets protesting, started to say the next step are elections. Mm-hmm. We have to set eyes on elections. And a lot of candidates for Senate and Cámara de Representantes started to, you know, listen to the young people and started to say, okay, I'm going to make your needs part of my campaign. And if I'm elected, you know, this project is going to be on Senate. Mm-hmm. And I think that was very positive. And now inside most of those people who protested, they organized and became part of some candidates. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I can name names
here. Sure.
For example, for Petro, there are a lot of committees that in cities like Cali are formed, and many of those are formed by people who protested. Mm. So because they say, okay, what we have to do next is this election. So I think that's a good thing after strike. You know, it's that awareness of the importance of participation in politics, at least voting. That's like the first step, but at least voting is key. The rest of things haven't changed because we're talking about poverty, and you can't change that in 1 year. And we're talking about strategies to give people more jobs, and you know, it just doesn't change, you know, from one day to the other. Mm. But I think we're walking to that. I think among the difficulties, because after the strike, a lot of people were arrested, they're still being arrested, they're accused. Like a month ago, a lot of people were taken to jail because of what they supposedly did on the strike. So yeah, actually on April 28th, a lot of people were, you know, celebrating, you know, 1 year, and they were arrested. And they were taken to jails and they were in process. There are a lot of in Silhouette people saying that are still killed. There are still people disappearing, so you know, things do not change that big. But I think political awareness is good.
Yeah, I mean, because there's been traditionally quite a high abstention rate in Colombian politics. Yeah. So, I mean, from your vantage point, you really, I feel, having been out on the streets and so on, that the young people are going to vote this time. How do you feel?
Look, on March, we had the first elections for Senate, and people didn't vote as much as we thought they were going to vote. So that kind of disappointed me a little bit. But I think these presidential elections are different, and people read them differently. Mm. So I think we have a chance that young people this time, on May, they are going to vote. Mm. Because I think they see the figure of president as a figure that can do more than a figure of a Senate, a senator. And I think that confusion, which is
not
confusion,
good.
Yeah, it's not good, no? But at least it starts to allow them to ask themselves questions about politics. Mm. So, okay, this guy, I should vote because, you know, my vote is going to help him go there and do what he promised to do. So I think I have hopes that these elections are going to be people are going to vote more. That's what I mean. So I hope that young people, as I've seen on social media, as I've seen on the streets during the campaign after the strike, as you know, as many people as they participate in those moments are going to vote, are going to go to vote and choose whatever they think is better for a country.
Yeah, I mean, I say to anyone, I mean, I can't vote. Obviously, I'm not a Colombian citizen, but I always say, Honestly, I really don't mind who you vote for because that's your right. Just vote.
Yeah.
You know, let's see the weight of people voting. And it is a worry, it is a concern to me that the Senate and House of Representatives, the Congress, wasn't as high because people here tend to believe that the president is all powerful, but without you know, a backing of a majority in Congress, he's not going to be. And that was a concern when you come out. You said, let's take the hypothetical that Gustavo Petro, the leftist candidate leading the polls at the moment, as we record this on the 9th of May, he gets in. It's going to be incredibly fragmented Congress and Senate. He'll have to make, coalitions and alliances, something that he's not good at all. He's not a.
Yeah, he has proven that he's not smart.
We know this. There's no compromise. Yeah. And so, and yet the narrative that the president is all powerful is still maintained by the current president. You know, when he spoke out against the Constitutional Court's ruling on abortion, saying, that five people can make this choice. He's like, well, hang on a second. That's why the Constitutional Court is there. It has nothing to do with you. You know, it's like,
exactly.
You sort of worry about this feeling.
And it's an oversimplification of the process the court takes to make the decision.
It's gone through years to get to that point. It's not the president then saying, but again, that's appealing to his base. That's appealing to his thing. And it's also a play in the elections. No, we know that he can't run again, for those of you outside of Colombia. But it's appealing for that side of things. I'm curious, there was one thing I forgot it, but we go back to the demonstrations in Cali, the Paro Nacional. What is the truth behind that the story or the reporting that was it an Éxito supermarket that was being used as a
torture
jail?
Place.
A torture place.
Yeah, torture. Well, that's the kind of things that happen in Colombia for those who are not in Colombia. We never get the truth of stuff like that. We still don't know exactly what happened because, as always, there are two versions. The authorities say that they never found anything, any proofs of any torture or any incarceration in that place and so on. But the organizations, social organizations, human rights defenders that went and checked the place said, we found stuff. We found stain of blood. We have testimonies of people living nearby hearing screams. We have videos of police getting into the Éxito supermarket. And then coming out of there, we have reports of people being dragged to exit, but there's no investigation.
No.
So we don't know to this day what happened. We have the suspicion that really something happened there. And again, if there are victims, they are too afraid to speak up.
Yeah.
They will not say unless some kind of, security stuff is around them to make sure nothing is going to happen to them. Mm-hmm. But they are not going to say anything. So we still don't know what happened. We have suspicions, but that's all.
And then the final point as well. What are your thoughts on the German lady who took place and was deported from Struber, something like that?
Struber, yeah. Rebecca
Struber. What are your? I've messaged her, but she hasn't responded.
Yeah, I did too, and she didn't respond. I think it was unfair. I mean, it was one of the things that this government just did to show up some results. It was she was, I think if she committed any crime, well, there are ways to make her pay the crime, but she didn't commit any crime. She was deported because she had some stuff with her permission to stay. It was something like that. It was nothing serious.
Yeah.
But around her, she was accused of being part of the guerrilla. She was accused of being violent. She was accused of a lot of things. Mm. And that was not the issue. The issue was some kind of permission stuff that it could have been resolved much easier. It could have been resolved in another way. It was just those things that the government liked to be here.
Also, it's a good thing to steer away the news as well. You can bury other news with the image of, a blonde foreigner joining demonstrations. And of course, we've got, you know, everyone falls back on the image of Irene, Tanya Niemeyer, the Dutch guerrilla, yeah. And you fall back on that. And so there's a stigma around it.
And you know, Richard, there's the bigger problem about that is that reinforced the story about the stories that were, they were told that, you know, the protests were backed up by Russians. Yeah. And, you know, Putin was trying to, and people just, you know, saw Rebecca and say, you see, yeah, it's true. The foreigners are trying to take over country. Russians are coming. So okay. It was sad. It was sad, really.
I quickly asked that. Have you found any evidence that the Russians are interfering in anything?
Not at all. Actually, you know, like 15 or a month ago, some media published a video of a guy speaking in Russian. And there was and they said, this is the proof. And I'm like, really? I mean, are you serious? This is the proof.
Right. I mean, I can be held to this and people can correct me in the future. But I mean, isn't it just we're taking ourselves, and I say it that because I live here and I've been here a long time, building up Colombia's importance on a world stage to say that Russia is getting involved because Colombia is a U.S. ally in the region and Venezuela. It just seems, I mean, again, you can all correct me if I'm wrong down the line. I will gladly, you know, pay the price for it somewhere. But it just seems a bit far-fetched that Russia should really be interested, you know, majorly interested in Colombia.
I agree. There's no reason to believe that Russia would be that interested in, say, oh, there are protests. This is a scenario I'd like to get involved. Hmm. There's no reason. I don't know. I'm not a political specialist or anything like that. But I don't think there's any political advantage for Russia to become involved in things like that. I mean, there's no sense to that. Yeah. But this is the narrative that helps people, you know, to say the left-wing's people are trying to take over and it's going to be a tragedy for Colombia. I think those things help them a lot. You know, even politics. Yeah. The high-profile politics in Colombia backed up that story and say, yeah, the Russians are coming. I think actually it was a candidate, he's not a candidate anymore, Oscar Iván Zuluaga, who publicly said that. He said, the Russians, if Petro is president, the Russians will take over. And people say, oh, you see, Oscar Iván says that, so it must be true.
Oscar Iván went to the same university as me in England, and and this is a side story. Once they got in touch with me, the university, through the alumni network, and said, oh, but we know that this is, you know, very high-powered politician. Perhaps we can use him, you know, to help build up the reputation of the university to get more Colombian students. And I was like, no.
Not him, please. Not him.
But on another note, so we've just come out of 4 days of paro nacional, which basically armed blockades by the AGC, so the Autodefensas Gaitanistas de Colombia, or the Clan del Golfo, which is an evolution of the Urabeños, which is an evolution of the other paramilitary groups. You can just chart it back. It essentially froze northern Colombia and most of Antioquia, aside from Medellin. So we're looking at Antioquia, Cordoba, Sucre, parts of Magdalena, Bolivar, I'm sure Atlantico as well, Cesar. Yeah. I mean, this is a huge swathe of Colombia, and it's a narco trafficking group, really. Yeah. Although it is political, because of course it stops commerce and it stops life, so there is a political element. I'm not saying that they're political in the way that the guerrilla originally was, but I'm saying political because of the way it affects society. In Cali, was there any reaction? Was there any was it tense at all? Was the paro evident?
No, because, you know, the group that led the paro, you know, do not operate in this area, so there was no worry about the constant worry here is what happens in Cauca, which has other groups, you know, disidencias, LN operating, and thus the groups. But regarding to that, in the north, no, there was no consequence, no, not at all. The only thing, you know, is that we worry about the reaction of the government, which we saw different from the reaction he had during the Paro Nacional last year. We said, okay, you show your force last year in Colombia, in Cali, you showed the whole force. Why didn't you show force there? What happened? And you know, that starts to, you know, create doubts about, okay, what's going on? You know, what's going on? You have a clearly illegal group, armed group, doing that, and your reaction is just do nothing. What's going on?
There was almost beyond like major parts of highways, there was nothing. There was nothing, you know, but in huge stretches. Yes, Colombia is really big. You can't police the whole country, but you know where they are. You know where the AGC is more powerful. You know where they're going to be. You know, it's this question. It keeps raising more questions. Now, finally here, and I won't take up more of your time, what concerns me for you is that local journalists are more at risk for reporting. So please, Jorge Luis, look after yourself. Look after your team, because it's always the local journalists on the ground. It's not the foreign journalists, because we get a special sort of dispensation for being international. It's you guys down there on the ground. So please be careful. That's what I'm asking you here as we end this podcast.
Richard, thank you very much. And I will. And I always tell my team, there's no story worth your life. So whatever, anything that you see as risky, just drop it. We have you know, all these protocol we can attend if necessary. So far it hasn't been. So gladly we've been doing our job freely.
Excellent. Now everyone, thank you. And I know you'll have enjoyed this. We've been talking to Jorge Luis Galeano Bolaños. He's in Cali, originally from Pasto, but he's in Cali there. And of course, check out his website, hechoincali.com. hechoencali.com. Of course, we'll put that on the Facebook page and in the show notes and so on. This has been episode 423. Just shortly, we will give you some messages from our sponsors on this episode. But thank you again, Jorge Luis, for your time and for clarifying so eloquently what's been going on in Cali this last year.
Oh, Richard, thank you very much for having me. I really, really hope I can give you a hint to understand this chaotic situation, because it's not easy to understand.
It's a tough one, and we've got the elections coming up. We will all be looking at Cali as well to see how it turns out. Because of course, I think the city probably remains quite tense in that respect.
Yeah. It's like anything can sparkle a protest again.
All right. Well, thank you again, and as I said, please stay safe.
Thank you very much, Richard, for having me.
And just a final reminder, this episode was brought to you by two sponsors this week. Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. You can sign up for a 14-day free trial at www.latinnews.com. So check them out, one of our kind sponsors. Our other sponsor is BNB Colombia Tours, experts in custom-made travel throughout Colombia. So you can think about travel to the major cities of Bogota, Cartagena, Medellin, the coffee zone, or more offbeat or off-the-beaten-track places such as Casanare or Guaviare, the Amazon. BNB Colombia Tours offer private packages, including pretty much anything you could possibly want. They will provide you and your loved ones with a fantastic private experience, creating wonderful memories of Colombia you'll cherish for a lifetime. So please check out their website at bnbcolombia.com. You complete the free itinerary form, and then for you guys, listeners of the Colombia Calling podcast, you mentioned that you heard this ad here on the podcast, and you'll get a further 5% off their already very competitive prices. So thank you again to our sponsors. That's BNB Colombia Tours and indeed LatinNews.com. That's me for this week. We'll be back next week again. Thank you for listening.